Good morning, world diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, Rabbit-O.
Rabbit-O. We're getting very, very casual this morning.
Cute and casual.
This is Peter, known as the Rabbit, and we've got some dining adventures for you.
It's really, most of the program is one of my most favorite things to do is interview chefs. I love chefs.
Yeah, what's not to like about chefs?
Yeah, I mean, they're really interesting people for the most part.
Especially good ones.
Yes.
And we have assembled...
We have the first one.
Three of the finest.
Yes.
And two of them are from New York, and one of them sandwiched in between from Pittsburgh. So there. First up, though, is someone who's just very quietly been operating in New York City for 20-something years, working with his wife. One location and then another location, famous for consistency, famous for French cooking in New York.
And this is his first book, which I find rather amazing.
Yeah, so the reason we had him on the program is because he just published a book all about the cooking at this restaurant called No Secret. It's called Chanterelle. David's been on the program before because we congratulated him when he won James Beard Award for Best Chef New York City. Last year, I think.
2007.
He's a remarkable fellow, and he had a lot of very, very interesting and thoughtful things to say.
Hello, David Waltuck. Congratulations on a very successful restaurant, Chanterelle, and your 30-year anniversary, and this gorgeous book that's sitting on the arm of my chair. Since it's so heavy, I can't hold it in my lap. It will make me go numb. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, fine. It's so good to see. It's such a good place. I mean, the hard business. How did you get involved? How did it all start, the story of Chanterelle, which is a legend in New York restaurants?
Well, the story, which is very well recounted in my new book, is basically of a kid who grew up in New York, and one of whose obsessions was restaurants and cooking and food. Long ago, before network and before the chef as sort of star, just something that I was obsessed with. And
how old were you when you went to that restaurant where it just sort of went on like a light bulb in your head?
Oh, God, we would go, my parents would take my brother, my younger brother, and myself to the theater, or to concerts and so on, very, very regularly, and it was always an excursion into Manhattan where we would have dinner at a restaurant, and most commonly though it would end up at a sort of a theater district, French bistro, and...
Weren't they awful?
Well, not in my memory,
Oh, I see. I remember them really bad.
But it was just such a different experience from my experience of food at home, I'm not one of those chefs that speaks, poetically about his grandmother's cooking or his mother's cooking, and that's how we learned to cook. That's not at all my story.
That's why I found it so amazing that you were drawn such a young age to cooking.
I think that, as like a lot of, especially young boys, I had sort of serial obsessions, whether it's Civil War history or scuba diving.
Dinosaurs.
They come and go, but the cooking thing stuck.
So you started out as a chef at what age, David?
Well, I started out, I guess I could call myself a chef when we opened our restaurant, because most of my actual professional experience has been at my restaurant, and that was at the age of 24 when we opened the first Chanterelle.
But you were cooking before.
I had finished college. I was majored in biological oceanography.
There you go. So of course you asked
a minor in art history.
So you were predestined to say, "Would you like fries with that, sir?"
Yeah, something like that.
David, do you know how many of us in the food world have degrees in art history? You know, Ruth Reichel does too.
Yes, I do.
And we both went to the University of Michigan within 10 years of each other, getting a master's in art history. Isn't that weird?
And then you started saying, "Would you like fries with that, sir?"
So I did, even though it became quite apparent to me at some point in my college career that this was not me, I did finish, and then I started cooking. I got a job in a little restaurant. I applied to Culinary Institute in upstate New York. I got in, and I went there for a while, and then I kind of got antsy and
dropped out. Well, you said you already knew so much more than you were being taught in class.
I don't know. I just felt that it was a worthwhile experience, but I really felt that I needed more, and it also felt like it was kind of repeating and kind of droning at a certain point, and I just wanted to move on.
Uh-huh.
And beyond that, on the personal side, I was seeing a person who is now my wife, who was in New York City, and I wanted to be in New York City where she was.
Uh-huh. And that's a romance in itself, isn't it?
It is. That's a big part of the story that's in the book.
Yes, and you mentioned that poetic in passing. I was really amazed that you waxed poetic in your descriptions of your love of food and your relationship with Karen, your wife. I mean, you're absolutely a romantic.
I am.
and
there are many of us out there. We just, even in New York, it has to be hidden under a kind of a crusty exterior so that nobody can see how soft and mushy we are.
But the story goes on. You said you were cooking at lunchtime, and then you'd have the evening off, so you would go out and buy fancy ingredients and do what you've been cooking at home. And friends said, well, you should have a restaurant of your own, so... 24
foolishly
years.
We listened to
foolishly,
them.
Well, like 30 years later at a James Beard.
Well, we're still here. We're still having fun.
Well, you're a James Beard Award winner for New York City, which is going to be the toughest of the areas as well. So
he's won a lot of awards.
And many people said it was long overdue, and why doesn't Waltuck get the recognition he deserves? And we talked to you briefly after that happened, and you were just as laid back then as you are now. It's just
I'm pretty humble.
There's some steel under this someplace. Now, how would you describe Chanterelle as a restaurant style?
Well, to answer that, I kind of have to go, back in history to the dark ages of the late 70s when we opened.
The
world was very different, and I mentioned the whole Food Network and the whole frenzy of chefs as stars and all that. That just was really absent then, or it was, if anything, in a very sort of early nascent phase. And so it felt fine to, it didn't feel like a crazy thing to do to open a restaurant. It felt more casual. Like, we'll open a restaurant and hopefully people will come, and it didn't cost $1 million to open a restaurant in those days. And what we wanted to do, I was very interested in what was going on in France at that time, which was essentially Nouvelle Cuisine, which is kind of a punchline or a joke at this point to a lot of people, but it really shouldn't be, because what Nouvelle Cuisine is basically the way everybody cooks now, except we just don't call it that.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that a chef could develop his own style, that seasonality was enormously important, that the best ingredients were enormously important, that you would not necessarily do classic dishes, but you would do your version of them, or you would come up with your own things. That's just the way it is now. But it was a little bit, it was revolutionary at that time. And so that's what really moved me. And that's what Chanterelle is about. Chanterelle is about my style of cooking, which is, if anything, it's an American cooking French food. So
that's a great explanation of it, or description of it.
An American who has never worked in a French restaurant in France, cooking French food. So, that also may tie in a little bit to your outing me as a romantic, because I have a very romantic notion about what a restaurant should be, what a great restaurant should be. And I wanted to make Chanterelle be, in a way, the American version of what a three-star dining experience in France at that time would be. And then the other very important aspect of our restaurant that, again, is somewhat taken for granted at this point, but then was very different, is just the style of the service.
Yeah, you can see that. It's amazing. You can see that in the pictures in the book. I'm not really sure why I see that, but I did see that in looking at all the pictures. It's clear that this is there's something very special going on in front of house, because you do have a friend called Karen who sort of makes sure that happens.
Right, and it's really, a lot of it is her. We always wanted our experience of eating, and we did eat in a lot of great restaurants in France before and after we opened Chanterelle, when in the pre-child days when we still could travel.
Yeah, you were hitting two star places too.
was that the fancy French restaurant in New York had very little to do with the fancy French restaurant in France. There was no, I did not experience condescension or haughtiness or, you know, any of that in Taillevant in Paris or in any of those kind of places. But in New York, that was a very real quality of those places.
Yeah, that was de rigueur, places like Grenouille and Le Grenouille and places like that. I guess that's the
it was something that developed here, I think, for whatever reason. And I just wanted to eliminate that. I wanted friendly, non-condescending, but very correct, very proper service. And we've always gone out of our way to get real people, smart people that can not only learn the way we do things here, but learn how to adapt to each table, each customer, each client, so that they give them the experience that, you know, within the boundaries of what Chanterelle can do and wants to do, the experience that they as clients want.
Now, you mentioned in the book that you added, if you like, a third leg to the stool when you found your sommelier, whose name I must confess I have quickly forgotten, but you have a page dedicated to Roger, and you say he just completed what we were trying to do.
Absolutely, and he's been here, you know, a long time, and hopefully will always be here, I think, probably.
And what's his name again, Roger?
His name is Roger Dagorn, and he's a master sommelier. He is someone who, as is related in the book, you know, when we were in our first sort of incarnation, which was in Soho on Grand Street, we were a tiny little restaurant. We're still a small restaurant, but we were a 30-seat restaurant, and we kind of did most everything ourselves, and, you know, put together the wine list as best we could, and, you know, there was no sommelier, is bottom line. But when we moved here, which is double in size, we realized that we couldn't do everything ourselves, and we certainly weren't experts on wine. So we had a series of sommeliers, and on a couple of occasions when someone left and we were looking for a replacement, we asked around to, you know, who would know who was good, and a couple of times we asked Roger, just called him up and said, we're in this situation, who do you recommend? And a couple of times he said, I suggest this person or that person. And then finally we called him one day, and he said, well, how about me?
Uh-huh.
And so we were very happy to say, it's you.
Yeah, no, that's
a great
story.
Out really well.
Now, let's go to this wonderful book, because we've talked about the restaurant, which is a subject in and of itself. But I have a question, because I look through it, and all the pictures are so beautiful, and the techniques look a little daunting to me. Now, I fiddle in the kitchen a little bit, mm-hmm. not nearly as successfully as Anne does, but you indicate that this really is a cookbook that home chefs can use?
I absolutely think so. If you really look at it, I'd say that there's nothing in there. There are recipes where there are many parts to things, but none of the individual parts, I think, should be daunting to a good home cook. My cooking is not super complicated.
You have none of these immersion heat circulators or whatever.
Well, that's after my time.
It's not my
thing. And I have honestly, certainly, have nothing against that whole movement.
No, I don't
it's
either.
Just not
just,
my style.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine how we could cook from the Alinea cookbook. I mean, how would you get the equipment?
Now, organizationally, you start at the beginning of the meal and you go through to the end, right? In the book itself.
Yes. Yeah. It's a normal sort of standard setup where there are hors d'oeuvres and there are soups and there are appetizers and
now,
main courses and so on.
Are these? This is my question. I've been hoarding up till I have a chance to dump this in. Are these real recipes that have been up till now secret from Chanterelle?
I don't believe in secret recipes. I
mean, okay.
But the truth, the answer to that is that I don't use recipes, so I had to make these recipes. I had to, you know, get in the kitchen with measuring spoons and scales and so on and so forth.
Yeah, this is not
unusual.
And try to
make something that I normally make in quantity without ever measuring, make it for four people, and see what it really is that goes into them.
Yeah.
And in some cases, sort of modified it, because when you're cooking for four people, sometimes you don't need to do some of the things that you need to do when you're making a sauce for 50 people.
But
sometimes, in a way, it's more organic to cook for four people because it's not a sauce that's been down over a long period of time that needs to hold and then get ladled onto a plate. It's a sauce that grows out of sautéing a piece of fish or a piece of meat, and then the whole process is streamlined in a funny way.
But do you give tips and secrets in the book?
Again, I don't believe in secrets. I don't but yes, lots of tips.
Lots of tips.
Yeah, you do give tips. Can you take a favorite dish and just sort of go through it for us and take us through the thought process and the construction process?
Oh, well, sure.
Pick any one you like.
Well, the sort of obvious one is the grilled seafood sausage, which is the only thing on our menu that never goes away. That's always there. We're kind of unique. We change our menu completely every 4 weeks. That means completely except for that one appetizer, which is the grilled seafood sausage. And by the by, in addition to changing the menu, that is the food that we're serving every 4 weeks, we change the cover of the
menu. Oh yeah, tell us about that too.
Every 6 months, and those menus are all done by different artists.
Well, first run through the sausage, and then
sure.
I wanted to ask you about that art program because you're having an exhibition come up. Tell us first about the sausage.
Yes.
Now you did this early on, didn't you?
It's one of the things that I sort of came up with when I was still playing around at home, before the restaurant opened, and it just seemed to stick. And it's just become our signature. I guess you have to have a signature dish, and so this is our signature dish. But it is, it seems complicated, but it's also very direct and simple, and I think that's what my food is. There's not a lot of unnecessary frills to it. And the seafood sausage, it was inspired by my reading of a description of a seafood sausage. It probably wasn't even a description, it was just a mention that some food writer had a boudin or fruit de mer or something like that along those lines at a restaurant called Taillevent in Paris. And I said, that sounds like a really interesting idea. So I set out to come up with a grilled seafood sausage. And what it is shrimp and scallops and lobster that are diced along with toasted pine nuts and then melted, bound together with a fish mousse. Like usually I use striped bass, but it could be any white fish. And seasoned, fairly delicately, but some brandy and some port, cayenne, and that's stuffed into a regular sausage casing and tied off and poached, and then at service time it's brushed with butter and grilled and browned and served with a kind of assertive beurre blanc sauce. So, but the funny thing is that years later, after I had been serving the seafood sausage at Chanterelle for some time, I had the opportunity to go to Taillevent in Paris, and they had this seafood sausage on their menu, and I ordered it, and it was completely different.
Oh,
completely
really?
Different
Isn't
approach true? than mine. And it's funny because I actually think it sort of epitomizes difference between sort of classic French cooking and the French cooking that I do. Because theirs was not browned, it was not grilled, it was poached, and it was in sort of large slices.
Uh-huh.
And very delicate. It was served, it had pistachios, and the seafood in it was more very finely cut, so that it was much more like a white pudding, like a boudin.
Uh-huh.
And the beurre blanc was much more delicate. The shallots were strained out. I leave the shallots in. So it was kind of like, I think, the very delicate and sort of perfectionist classic French cooking versus the kind of somewhat more brash and more full flavored and more, hey, maybe we can brown this and get another layer of texture in it. American approach to sort of the same thing.
That's a very good metaphor for what your cooking is. I mean, how it is, or you know what I'm saying. That explains a whole lot about your style, I think. Now, you mentioned, and we mentioned this, your art program.
Yes.
And, I mean, as I read it, you thought that art on the walls would distract diners from the the plates and the food in
front
of them?
Beyond that, we were in Soho, which is a loft, you know, cast iron, old loft district, which throughout the 70s was kind of emptied as manufacturing and the warehouses kind of moved away. And so that area became sort of colonized by artists because these were these big lofts with lots of light and they could work in them. And so it was at that time very much of an artist's district area. There were starting to be some really great galleries there. And so we felt a connection to that, and we wanted to be part of that in our own way. And we felt it was sort of politically wrong to put up, to say, okay, we're going to put your picture up on the wall, but not your picture up on the wall. And we wanted the dining room to be rather simple. And, you know, the Chanterelle is almost like an old-fashioned idea of what a restaurant is. There's no waterfalls, and there's no, you know,
Lordy, Lordy.
You know, whatever there is, and, you know, there's no giant Buddhas or any of that kind of thing. It's a room. It's a very pretty room with tables and chairs and china and silverware, and there are flowers, and that's it. And it's intended to, as much as possible, minimize the feeling of business being done. There's no obvious cash register. There's no bar that you can see. When you get a bill, it's handwritten, just like the menu is handwritten. So anyway, we wanted to keep it simple, and we wanted art to be part of it, but we didn't want to say to choose one person's art over another person's art. So our person, that our good friend who was also the designer of the restaurant, suggested that we do the menu covers and have them change pretty often, and that's what we've done ever since the very beginning. Sometimes the artists are clients who are friends. Sometimes they're just people that we sort of say, hey, would you like to do a menu?
Well, you've had some really big established artists as well in there. And it's all going to be in an exhibition in New York?
We're hoping that there's going to be, that the menu collection will be acquired by the New York Public Library, and that they're planning a show of them, and which will in some way coincide with our 30th anniversary, which is actually next year.
Oh, next is 2009. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, David, we could talk to you absolutely all day. We'll simply say this: we'll continue the conversation next time we come to New York City, and you can
show us
a few more things, and we'll record our real life experience.
Meanwhile, everybody should get this book because it's just one of those books that I can't explain. It's an era, but it's still contemporary. Do you understand what I mean?
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's.
And of course you can get it through OTM Bookshelf. You can undoubtedly probably get one if you stop by the restaurant. It's called Chanterelle, Chanterelle. The website is Chanterelle, NYC, I think, David?
That's right, NYC.
.com. And I'd just like to say thank you so much for being a part of our program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
As we say goodbye, if you can hang on the line, because we have a question I want to ask you off air.
Great.
And thank you so much for joining us, sweetheart.
Yes, David. We just love the conversation and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're waiting for your email onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, or also share with us your thoughts on onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Yeah, the blogger is very lonely, so please jump on board and contribute something, even if it's only to say hi. We're beginning to wonder whether we should have a blog at all. But, of course, we'll keep blogging along because that's what we do. And we did the email thing already?
We did. So we're setting up our next guest who sometimes Pittsburgh gets really lucky when a talented native son, goes out into the broader world, cooks, and then decides that he or she wants to return to family. And that's what happened with our next guest, Chef Chet Garland.
And the wonderful thing about it is he took over a space that's been an empty corner of many people's hearts in Pittsburgh, because he took over the space that used to be Tony and Becky Pye's Bon Vivant. So we're delighted that he's there, and of course we caught up with him and talked to him about what he's doing.
On the menu, we'll follow around the chef, Chet Garland, because we love him, we love his food. And you've been around, you've been cooking in a variety of places. I'll let you elaborate on that, but I just wanted to say congratulations. You've just opened one of the most charming new restaurants in Pittsburgh, and it's called Toast Kitchen and Wine Bar. You and your partner, Paul Tipp, it's wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
So you started out, actually, in Zelianople, which is pretty close to Pittsburgh, but then you went to Rhode Island to school.
Yes.
And then you cooked around other places. You were in the South for a while.
Yeah, I was in Richmond, Virginia for about 5.5 years, working at Le Mer at the Jefferson Hotel, and also opened a place called Cabo's Corner Bistro, where I was the executive chef there for a few years, and was one of the best restaurants in the city. Both places were the top two in the city about 4 out of the 5 years that I was down there.
Yeah, well, you were at Halo here in Pittsburgh, and then you were 9 and 9 for a while.
Yeah.
And now your own place.
Yes, exactly.
You transformed the space.
Thank you. Yeah, we took a place that was kind of outdated. Yeah, a little outdated for the time now. But back in the day, it was, you know, the best restaurant in Pittsburgh. You know, Tony did a great job with the space and did, you know, what he did for 13 years. And was best restaurant for like 9 out of the 13 years,
yeah.
Or in the top 3
yeah.
in the city at that time.
Right.
And we just hope to do exactly what Tony did. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just, upstairs was so dreary before, and now you've made it into private dining. I've been looking at your menu, drooling, I might add. What is your concept? I mean, I know you believe in approachable food, but this is not routine food. I mean, talk to us about your intention here.
Well, we wanted, like you said, approachable food, but we wanted food that was also a little bit modern, but not too modern, but also bring some like old classics back. You know, doing escargot with just angel hair pasta and garlic butter, you know, it's just simple and good, using a great product. And the escargot, it's the same ones that, you know, like Jean Georges is using, Keller's using, chefs like that are using. We're just, you know, it's the snail man. They're just really beautiful product and just doing simple preparation.
It's a snail man?
Yeah. And it's just, they're really good. They're really flavorful. And we just wanted to do simple, good food, but put a little bit of a modern twist on it. You know, you can see a lot of my southern influence
on
the menu.
Yeah, you have grits on the menu, but they're special grits.
Yeah, we do a little bit of habanero cheddar cheese in them to give them a little bit of spice to them. We use a nice little company right outside of Richmond called Bird's Mill. They're a little family-owned place that's really nice. They do a really great job. And
there's such a difference in grits. I had to drag Peter kicking and screaming to taste grits, because he was used to the stuff they would slop on the breakfast plates, you know, in motels and stuff.
Yeah, when I first moved back to Pittsburgh, that's what everyone thought was the IHOP. You know, no offense to IHOP, but the IHOP, like, white cream, almost like
right.
cream of wheat kind of grits that had no flavor. These actually have a nice corn flavor to them.
Right.
You know, they're really nice. They're
well, he's a convert now, because we've had great grits in, like in and around Charleston and so forth. You also are aiming here, I think, to reasonably priced and accessible in that way, too.
Yes, that's we wanted to use great products like 9 on 9 and Uses, 11 Uses, a lot of the other restaurants. Since we didn't put a lot of money into the space, we wanted to give a reasonable price on drinks and food. So we wanted to have a nice atmosphere, good priced food, and let people come out more than just a special occasion, that they could come out once a month if they choose to, or we get some customers in here that come in once or twice a week.
Oh, see, that's great. That's
yes.
That's your bread and butter. Yeah.
And the menu's divided into sections, right? So the name Wine Bar really holds up?
Yes. We get a lot of people that do the way it's broken up, it looks like it's coursed out. But we recommend people to do pretty much whatever they want, however they want to order food. We get a lot of people that will order an entree for like their second course and then finish up with like the duck confit salad because it is a little bit more like a bigger portion because it's the whole leg and thigh that we keep it all together. So, you know, we pull that thigh bone out so you get that real good crispy skin and then, you know, you got the spiciness of the arugula and the sweet vinaigrette to it. So it's really beautiful. And I leave the herbs on the duck so you get that nice herb flavor. So it brings out some more like earthy flavors to the duck. It's really nice. We're getting great compliments on that. The barbecue lamb ribs, we get amazing compliments on that.
They look wonderful.
Yeah, I smoke them for like 3 hours, and then I braise them in the barbecue sauce for about another 3 hours, so they just fall off the bone. You know, a lot of people get those as entrees, where they'll, you know, a lot of people will split like the chicken for a second course, and then get lamb ribs and like a duck salad for their third course, and then. It's nice. It's all about like comfort food and simple. You know, the short ribs are just braised short ribs with Yukon Gold potatoes and root vegetables. It's just good and simple. You know, I put a little bit of like red onion marmalade on top of it just to add a little bit extra to it. But it's all about simple and good.
You know, I see some flyers listed on here like Gerber's Farm Chicken. You've always been really big on driving around farms and getting to know producers, huh?
Yeah, and I'm trying to get more and more of that in the Pittsburgh. Unfortunately, with Big Burrito being so big, they've tied up a lot of local farmers because they're so big. So for me to get like Three Sisters Farms in, I can only get like little bits and pieces of stuff from them because they supplied to Big Burrito first and then people like the smaller places like me second. So trying to get more and more back into that. And unfortunately, we opened up so late in the season that it was hard to do that. But I've made quite a few good contacts to start next season off really with a bang.
Oh,
so
great.
You'll see more and more of that coming up next year. You know,
well, tell us about some other of these dishes. I see one dish on here that I despise. That might be a good test. Try me on catfish. I hate it. Absolutely hate it.
I just wanted something that was just, you know, in Pittsburgh, it's hard to find good fish. And that's, with me being so small and just starting up, it's hard for me to find a supplier that will give me what I want and the quantities I want with the quality I want without charging me so much money. Like, they'll get stuff flown in, you know, I'm talking $60 extra on top of whatever the price is just for shipping. So there's certain places I can't afford to use without trying to keep in our price range that we want to keep. So, you know, unfortunately, using like something like catfish, which I like catfish because it's inexpensive, but it also has good flavor and good texture. Oops, sorry about that. But it's not like a tilapia that, you know, like a lot of your chain restaurants are using. It's something, you know, it's southern. And that's southern for me. Using, you know, I got braised greens on it, which I got local greens. So I got a mixture of like four different kinds of kale.
So
you get a little sweet and you get a little like spiciness and a little bit of bitter in the kales. So it adds to the dish using, you know, I got sweet potatoes on there. One of the local farmers brought me fingerling sweet potatoes. And they're about 6 to 8 inches long and only
I've never even seen that.
And they're only about a quarter to a half dollar in size, you know, in diameter.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. I got three different kinds. I got red sweet potatoes, white sweet potatoes, and just regular, you know, your, I guess, orangish sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful. And it's just having stuff like that that I wanted something southern. So it was the only fish I could have to get at that time was catfish that was nice.
Well, on one hand, he is catfish. On the other hand, he is black truffle.
Yes,
Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, with beets and truffles coming in the season at the same time, I wanted a classic dish, something that was just, you know, really good local beets with, you know, really good truffles, and just putting those two together in a just real simple aspect of it.
When we came in today, you said, Anne said, can I have a menu? And you said, well, yeah, let's look at today's menu. So how frequently does the menu change?
We change the menu probably 2 to 3 times a week at least. It really goes on supply and demand. The seafood changes at least once or twice, if not three times a week with what I can get in. I just received some Scottish salmon today.
Oh, that's good.
you know, it's one of those things that's, if the quality's not there, why do I want to have it on the menu? So I'd rather take something off the menu that the quality's not there. So instead of putting something on and serving something mediocre, I'd rather eliminate it from the menu. I had venison on the menu for the weekend, and we sold out of it. Unfortunately, I can't get any venison from a supplier until next week, so venison won't go back on the menu. So I'd rather have stuff that I can get when I can get it, and it be a really great quality, instead of having something on a menu that's just mediocre at all times. Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit about all the different, because this is meant to be flexible and accommodating. What are the different uses that diners can expect? I mean, you have a main dining room, a bar, stairs rooms. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, upstairs is...
And before I forget, I want to say that this gorgeous interior, comfortable interior, mainly you did it by yourself, you and your father, by hand.
And a lot of friends.
And with a lot of love.
Yeah, and a lot of friends helped out. You know, with the simple construction.
But tell us about the facilities, and also about your Tuesday tasting.
Yes. So the facilities downstairs, what we have is we set up a nice casual bar that's, you know, butcher block top with some cork inlay on the bar, just to make a nice. We wanted the downstairs to look like someone's basement, almost like in wine country, where you could come in and do wine tastings and feel comfortable, feel like you're sitting in your house almost in a basement. You know, exposed rafters, some nice lighting.
I didn't even know. I practically lived in this place when it was in a previous incarnation as a restaurant, and I never knew you had rafters.
Yeah, it was amazing to see what we found once we started taking. You know, some plaster down to put up new plaster, you know, to fill in holes, to put up paintings and stuff. And amazing to see what came about. There was some really neat stuff that, you know, came around just by just taking down the acoustical tiles and just, you know, saying, hey, let's just oil down the rafters just leave them. They look pretty. They make a space look bigger than what it is.
It does look bigger, actually.
Yeah. It adds, realistically, we took out, it's inch higher than the original ceiling, but once you add that space in between the rafters, you gain another 12 inches. And then the walls, we took out a little partial wall. The bar used to only sit like four people.
Yeah.
Doubled the size of the bar, we took out a little partial wall.
That's where the wall was. I remember, right.
Yeah. There was a little partial wall there, and there was big mirror, and he had a big round table set up there.
Yeah, I remember that now.
So we took out that little partial wall, so it just opened the space up and just made it look bigger than what it is. And you know, we put some couches down here just to make it, so I have a small waiting area where Tony didn't have that before. It was just, you know, everyone was just sort of standing, mingling in a corner instead of, you know, having a place to sit down and relax.
And what about upstairs? Now, that used to be so gloomy.
Upstairs, we put some brighter colors on the walls and some nice little wood accents on the walls just to make it in what used to be Tony's office. We found behind the one wall, trying to patch in some plaster, there was a old fireplace buried in the wall.
You're kidding.
Hidden behind a whole bunch of plaster.
Now, this is listed as a wine bar, and your partner, who's unfortunately busy getting ready for a party tonight, he was a wine man anyway, right?
Yes. Paul just recently came from the Big Burrito Group. He was wine director at 11. And also,
which is upscale. Yeah,
and also Soba. He was at Soba for a while, and
that's where I first met him at Soba. Yeah.
So, and he learned from a master sommelier in out in Philadelphia when he was at Savona. Uh-huh. He learned from a master sommelier out there, and so he really took that and drove with it. Our wine list is extensive but small.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, can you just briefly describe what to expect from the wine?
We roughly have 60 to 80 bottles on hand at all time. We have usually about 30 to 40 of them by the glass. And what we do is we break our bottles into three, where a lot of people will break it into four or five. We pour our bottles in third. So what we do is we give you a little canner. So we give like an 8-ounce pour is roughly what
nice.
We get. So it's easy to share with wine. Like if one person orders a red and one orders a white, we bring extra glasses to the table. So it's meant to be shared. Food and wine's meant to be shared.
Yeah,
you know, we wanted that's what we went after. So our prices are really reasonable if you look and see that they're broken up into thirds versus fours, you know, fours or fives like a lot of other people do in the city.
Your cocktail list is fairly small. I'm sure you have plenty of stuff you can make things up from scratch.
Yeah, no, we actually have another book. This is, the back of the menu is set up where all glasses and a couple little cocktails. And then we have another book that has more cocktails in it. And, our beer list, which is a lot of local beers on our beer list. We only offer a few beers and, but we do have a full bar with a lot of really good bourbons, scotches, we didn't really want to keep with lower end stuff, but we're not super high end either. We have that nice medium to high end.
Now, what's with the name? Why Toast? When I heard that name, I said, I'm not so sure about that name. It gives you kind of the wrong idea. I mean, you could say that man's toast or he's toast. Then you said, Toast Pittsburgh.
Yeah. We wanted something that meant food and wine. So as you like toast bread or you toast people in celebration with a glass of champagne, we wanted something that meant both. And it was just something, we wanted something really simple that people could remember, not a French name or Italian name that someone doesn't know how to pronounce. We wanted something simple. And yeah, a lot of people say, well, it sounds like breakfast. But it's
well, I finally got it after a while, and I can't wait to taste this. And can I toast you?
Yes, please.
I wish you every success of the world, Chuck Arlen. Thank you for
talking
to us. And with that, it's time again to take a break.
And we hope you'll be with us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and up next, our third chef for the day, is Andrew Carmelini, and he has a book, and I think you'll find that it's very different from what you might expect from the usual chef's cookbook, as he is very different from what you might expect from the average chef.
It's really intriguing, but one of the most intriguing things about Andrew, however, we do mention it during the interview, is that he's a chef without a restaurant at the moment. But we're sure that's not going to last for too long, and we did ask him about that too, because lots of people remember his wonderful cooking at Avoce, and they're most anxious to have him back. And the good news, all you fans of Avoce and Andrew Carmelini, is that he is on the way back, but you'll get some details if you listen through the interview.
Chef Andrew Carmelini, welcome back to On the Menu. We've interviewed you before, and we've enjoyed your food, and we're now looking at your hot new book, Urban Italian. What a great title for a book. Could you tell us what made you title it Urban Italian?
Well, I live in Manhattan, and this book came about because before I opened up my last restaurant, I had about a year off and was cooking a lot at home. And, a kind of standard small Manhattan apartment kitchen. And it was just, this life I was living that summer and spring of, getting on N train, going out to Brooklyn, getting some groceries at the Italian neighborhood there, coming back into the city and then lugging the groceries home, and then going to Union Square to get the vegetables, walking home with the vegetables. It just became this kind of very urban, kind of cosmopolitan process in testing the book, because I tested every single recipe in the book in my apartment kitchen because I really wanted it to be a home book.
Right, so everybody could cook from this now.
Right, as opposed to like a coffee table chef book, which are lovely, right. And I have many of them. It's just that this first book I wanted every recipe to have a story and to be kind of very personal.
Right.
And that's how
it
came about.
And it certainly is. You start out with a whole sort of biographical section, which I found fascinating. You really have a knack for writing.
Well, no, it's not me. If I wrote this book, then very short sentences, and I would have gave the copy editor a lot of work.
And this is Gwen?
Gwen is my wife, and she co-wrote the book with me.
Okay.
And we're still married at the end of it.
We had an episode like that in my house, too. Anne wrote a book, and it was almost the end.
Well, this went pretty good. We were a pretty good team through this. She tested every single recipe with. I would, cook, and she would sit on a table, on a chair in the kitchen with the laptop on her lap, and you know, type away as I told stories and tested these recipes. And then we did another step just to really make sure everything pretty good for the home cook. I sent it out to all my family and friends.
Oh, that's good.
And I said, well, if you test this recipe, then I'll give you a book. And everyone participated.
That's good.
You mean you didn't cook them a meal?
Now, this book has been selected for the Gourmet Magazine Cookbook Club.
Yes.
And I believe it's because it's one of those wonderful cookbooks that people can actually cook from, which is getting to be rather difficult these days with the vanity books out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I didn't want it to be. I really wanted it to be very personal and tell very personal stories, but also, you know, that even like the details on the book, you know, was a big deal with, you know, me and my publisher that I wanted to make sure that when you opened it up, it actually, the pages stayed folded instead of... It's like there's a special way that you even stitch the book together, which I found out, where so it works like a cookbook instead of having to like rip the pages back or put it in a holder.
Uh-huh.
I really want to make sure that you could actually put it on the counter and the pages folded over.
Well, yeah. I'm trying that. It doesn't work on every page, by the way.
This is more than just a cookbook, though. This is we started off with a mini life story. Now, when we talked to you before, we were actually talking about why you became a chef. As part of a collection of chefs who revealed their secrets.
How I learned to cook.
But it seems to me that you reveal something more of yourself in the introduction of this book even than you did then.
Well, yeah, it's definitely tells the story about the Italian years, because my background's kind of in French cooking and in Italian cooking, both in France and in Italy, in many, many years in New York. And, you know, the entertaining stories, they're sometimes not always the most flattering.
Uh-huh.
So that's what, you know, I just wanted to kind of, you know, tell some of the great stories that happened along the way. Sometimes they're inside a kitchen, sometimes they're not.
There's some wonderful unvarnished truth and a few Gordon Ramsay words in there, too. listeners, this is not for the squeamish. I mean, if you're squeamish about four-letter words in the English language, skip to the recipes. There aren't too many of them there.
One of the things that Gwen did very well is that she captured my voice, and you know, I really we didn't want to edit anything out, and tried to keep it real, not in a way to kind of like beat your chest and say I'm Gordon Ramsay style kind of thing, but just it's kind of like real life, and I really wanted to keep it that way.
Oh, and it reads exactly that way, and
it reads as though you're talking about
how you got involved in the whole process and what you learned along the way. And after all, if you don't make mistakes, you can't learn anything.
No, that's for sure. Sometimes you learn more from the mistakes than you do from your greatest triumphs.
And you have, in addition to gorgeous photography of the completed dishes, you have photographs of the process and techniques, which is very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of those processes, especially like, you know, that are kind of like near and dear to me, like the gnocchi, for example. I mean, it's really a recipe that has five ingredients, and one of them is salt. But a lot of times when you have those recipes that have five ingredients, they're easier to mess up.
Really?
Because there's the certain steps along the way that make, you know, transform those simple things into something great. And it's the visual aspect, I think, for that particular one, and there's some raviolis, and there's a couple other pasta things, help visualize that. Because you can't, even though we tried our best to, you know, describe that through the language, seeing the visual representation really makes the difference.
Now, so your background was basically Italian. You started cooking very early, and your first restaurant was so-called Italian, was really American-Italian, right?
Yeah, kind of your standard, you know, mozzarella sticks, penne vodka sauce, chicken scallopini, 100 ways, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be quite delicious, but that's the American-Italian food that most people know and love.
Uh-huh.
But you tell the story of grated Parmesan cheese in Palermo and wonder, you know, what happened. Did the Palermitanos get, were they corrupted, or was the grating of Parmesan really the correct thing to do?
I mean, that story, I mean, refers to that, you know, the way I was taught, you know, just, you know, growing up in kitchens, is that you never grated Parmesan cheese on top of seafood risotto.
Right.
Or seafood pasta, ever.
Right.
And then even, you know, I have some dear friends in Rome that have a couple of restaurants in New York, and I actually have seen them not do it in their restaurant and have the customers walk out before they will do it. and then tells a story about it. But they, you know, they're from, you know, Rome and north, south of Rome. They don't care. And they actually, they put, you know, Parmesan cheese or pecorino cheese on top of the seafood pastas, and I saw it many, many times, and it's not that bad.
No. Now, you've been all over Italy. What are your favorite cuisines? Which parts?
Well, you know, the first part of my kind of Italian traveling life was always up north, and that's where I worked, you know, visiting all the wineries and all that kind of thing. And it really wasn't until probably about six years ago that I started to really discover southern Italy, south of Naples.
Mm-hmm.
I find the cooking in Campania and Sicily to be great.
Yeah.
It's very, very different from the cooking like around Bologna, which is great, and Piemonte. But it's heavy. It's heavier. There's more butter, there's more cream, more richer types of food. You know, down south you get, you know, more olive oil-based dishes, more seafood-based dishes, and there's just there's more vibrancy, I think, in the cooking. You get kind of like North African influence in there, and you get like a little bit of chili and more citrus. So you can eat almost every night out down in Sicily or Campania and still feel good after three or four days of eating, you know, the food from Emilia Romagna.
Which is where we were just most recently, Emilia Romagna.
Yeah, we were just there. Have you come across our good friend Massimo Bottura?
Oh, yeah, Massimo.
From Osteria Francescana?
Yeah.
We had a wonderful four-hour lunch with him just about a month ago. We can still remember the taste sensations of it.
Just 4 hours? It was a short lunch.
Yeah, that included a brief interview as well.
Yeah, you also list as a reference Le Calandre, which is another one of our favorites.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, Le Calandre is great because he kind of bridges the gap between more modern cooking and more traditional cooking.
Right.
I think the molecular gastronomy in Italy, you know, it's to take it 100% of the way with the techniques, if you take some of the soul out of the cooking. And I think, you know, they do a great job there of keeping the soul, but also, you know, moving forward. And it's in very modern cooking, but you still have some of the soul in Italian food.
Right.
Yeah, Massimo told us, he said, I just went, I'm so far beyond where I was with molecular gastronomy. Mm-hmm. And he's just going to keep on changing, and it's going to continue to be fascinating. Now,
he was talking about Le Calandre.
Yeah, but we also talked about Osteria Francescana too.
Right.
Now, you have some more adventures in your future. So beyond this wonderful urban kitchen cookbook, you said, I think you have an urban French. You have an urban French idea as well.
Well, I was joking with someone the other day that the next one would be called Urban French, maybe, because that's my kind of other half of my cooking life. Nothing in the works yet, but you know, I'm working on my new restaurant.
Can't tell us where it's going to be yet. You don't know, and you can't.
No. We have part of the secret. Come on, Andrew, give us the part of the secret you did off the air.
I mean, really, it's going to be south of 23rd Street.
Yeah.
And north of Staten Island.
So in case you don't know those landmarks, listeners around the world, that means it's going to be in New York City.
No, it's going to be, we're going to be downtown Manhattan.
Manhattan.
I have two locations right now we're kind of negotiating through. And it's a casual place, the kind of place that I've been wanting to open up for years.
Small. Small.
Yeah, I mean, small. It's a relative term. Small. I probably like, you know, 80, 100 seats.
Oh, that's big then.
Not too small, not too big, but very, very, very casual. I promised myself it would be casual.
Okay, and you don't know though what style it would be. You said you weren't sure if it'd be Italian or American or.
Life would be easier if I just liked only cooking one kind of food.
Okay.
I kind of have the same problem with music as I have with food. It's just I have many eclectic tastes, and I travel a lot, so I love food from all over. I think that, you know, New York is, it's odd that way, is that usually, I feel that you find a space and then kind of create a restaurant around it because every little location is different.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I've heard that before.
It's kind of like, okay, I feel this can be a great bistro, or this could be a great trattoria, or this could be a great diner, or whatever you want. It's not that I set out to, you know, I want to open up X and then I'll find the perfect space for it. It's like I find this great space and then let's open up something around it and then kind of create it that way.
Well, yeah. There are a lot of people who followed you at Da Voce and who pined when you left Cafe Ballou, and they're saying, come back, Andrew, so don't hang around there.
And back to your book here, you have your introduction, you have your bio material, you have true stories, Great photographs. And then you say, hi, welcome to the recipe section, right?
I'm glad you're pointing that out. You know, okay. I've been doing a lot of talking with a lot of people about the book, and you're the first person that's pointed out that.
Oh, okay.
So there is actually a recipe. That's a surprise. It's a cookbook, so there's a recipe. You know, here's
let him please explain what the section that I'm talking about.
Well, it's a couple pages just before the recipe section where it's just I just give some kind of thoughts and tips about cooking, really.
Right.
Cooking at home. I think the first thing I say really is don't stress out. And, you know, another thing I say is that, you know, don't be afraid to taste, touch, smell, or feel.
And make a mess.
Or make a mess. I think cooking should be about enjoyment. If you're not enjoying the process of cooking, then go out to eat.
Yeah. So, but this one's one of my tenets here is measure, but don't be a slave.
Are you a measurer?
No. I can tell in the palm of my hand what's a teaspoon, tablespoon, quarter teaspoon, the whole thing. I mean, I don't use the utensils.
I find that cooks become in two varieties, the ones that measure and the ones that don't.
Okay. But you see, I don't bake. If I baked, I'd have to measure.
Well, that's the other thing. And usually the ones that love to measure they tend to be more better bakers than not.
Uh-huh. So then you have other sections on ingredients. This is obviously, it's almost a tutorial for the home cook in Italian food, I would think. And the recipes, Andrew, are just great.
Oh, thank you very much.
So you're going to let us know when this restaurant develops?
I'm going to try to keep it a secret as long as possible. And then when I'm ready to talk about it,
will you come back on?
I'll say something.
Okay, when you're ready to talk about it, please come on to the show and let all of our listeners know where you are and what you're doing.
I will. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's great. Well, we love talking about you to everybody. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I said we love talking to people about you.
Oh, well.
But before we went on the air, I said the last person I talked to recently said you were quirky.
Well, I don't think I've been called worse than that, so... So I'll take that.
Okay.
I wouldn't think I was, but you never know.
See, I didn't think you were either, which might mean that I'm quirky. Anyhow, Andrew, good talking to you again, and I hope to hear from your restaurant soon.
Great.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Have a good day.
Bye.
It's hard to believe that we're in the end of another show already.
Yeah, I guess that wraps it up. Three chefs, three different personalities, and a lot of interesting conversation. But, as you say, I think that's our program for this week.
So we'll hope to see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.